Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Well, it's Hall of Fame week in basketball, so we have a special Hall of Fame-centric podcast for you today. Dennis Scott was one of Shaquille O'Neal's closest friends in the NBA and had a front row seat for Shaq's early years in Orlando. We'll check in with Dennis. And you can't talk about Allen Iverson without talking about Larry Brown, AI's longtime coach in Philadelphia. Larry joins me in the podcast as well. All right, let's go.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Well, the Hall of Fame ceremony for the NBA, for basketball, I should say, is this week coming up. And I don't know if it's the most decorated class ever, but it certainly is among the most star-studded. You've got Allen Iverson, maybe the most gifted little man to ever play the game. You've got Yao Ming, one of the most impactful centers, impactful players in general from abroad ever to come into the NBA. And you've got Shaquille O'Neal, one of, if not the most dominant big man of all time. To talk more about Shaq, I want to bring in Dennis Scott, the former NBA player, former teammate of Shaq for 4 years in Orlando, now an analyst for NBA TV and Turner. And Dennis joins me here on the podcast. Dennis, 4 years with Shaq. Your first year was Shaq's rookie year with him in 92. What do you remember about your early interactions with Shaq?
A very, very naive, jovial, big kid that loves life. And I think for me, that's the blessing that I got a chance to get to know the early Shaq versus the finishing Shaq. And what I mean by that, he was learning who he was as a player. He was learning who he was as a person. So when he got to Orlando, you saw a fresh kid out of college coming to the NBA, wanting to dominate, but trying to figure out who he was. And I think that's the most fascinating thing about Shaq. If you really look at his career from beginning to end, he played a certain way. He thought about changing his game, and I always tease him to this day because Patrick Ewing and David Robinson are his favorite players growing up. And I said, Shaq, you don't need a jump shot like they do. You continue to dominate on the block, continue two dribbles, dunking on people. And as we know now, it's called barbecue chicken.
You say he was naive coming in. In what way?
That he could honestly dominate and own the league. He'll tell you now that his first couple of years, he wasn't for sure that he could come in and dominate right away. And that was part of that confidence that he's willing to admit it now, or say his first 5 years, he wouldn't admit it. But when he got to L.A. and he got around Phil, and Phil got into his head, and Phil really showed him how to work hard, and they gave him the triangle, and they just really showed him how to dominate, that's when Shaquille's career really, really took off.
You were in your third year when Shaq came around, and you guys developed a pretty strong friendship over those 4 years and beyond, obviously, in Orlando. Did you expect to become as good of friends with him as you did?
Had no idea. Didn't know what to expect. John Gabriel was the general manager at the time in Orlando, and we're still good friends to this day. And the story is true. It's consistent. I'm at home watching TV. John Gabriel calls me, says, Shaq is stuck at the airport hotel. You mind going to pick him up and show him around town? And that was the beginning, you know, of our friendship. We liked music, you know, souped up cars, the SUVs, the speakers, all that stuff. In our young 20s, Shaquille and I kind of met eye to eye, so to speak, off the court. And that's kind of how our friendship began. And then on the court, it was a perfect combination because he was inside, I was outside. When he got double teamed, I was his insurance blanket to kick it back out and knock down a three. And after I made a couple shots, then the opposing team would say, don't leave him. And then he was able to dominate.
So when you got to show Shaq around town that first time, what does that even look like? Where do you guys go?
Well, we started calling him the Shaq Piper, obviously, like the Pied Piper. Yeah. Everywhere we went, downtown Orlando, International Drive, Disney, Universal Studios, everyone was looking up and said, oh, that's Shaquille O'Neal. That's the big guy everyone's talking about on TV. That's the big kid that dominated the NCAA tournament. So the name was starting to grow, but once you got a chance to see him in person and then realize he was a soft-spoken kid, he loved people, he loved, you know, the elderly. I mean, with the transit people being on the street, he would pass out money. I'm like, dude, don't give away all your money. He's like, man, I hate seeing people walk on the street in need. So all the stuff we've seen from Shaquille O'Neal over the years has been genuine. And for me, I've been blessed to see it up close.
He obviously left Orlando at a certain point. But when he got there, I mean, how did he like Orlando? Did he embrace it? Was it a good fit for him in those early years with his personality?
I think it was a perfect fit, and I think it speaks to where he lives at now. He lives in Orlando in the off season. He has a huge house in Isleworth. I used to live in Isleworth, Brian Shaw, and a lot of us did back in the day. But Shaquille O'Neal is a big personality, but deep down inside, he's really a laid-back guy, which is weird to hear from someone so big and so boisterous. But at the end of the day, Shaquille O'Neal likes to go home, be around his family, be around his kids, and relax. And I think that's what's all said to be done for him still living in Orlando to this day.
I want to ask you about some of the relationships that were there during those 4 years of Shaq. And start with Scott Skiles. And how would you describe the relationship between Skiles and Shaq?
It became respectful. Early on, you know, the story's well told. I think in the 30 for 30, about the big fight we had out in L.A. At the time, Shaquille understood that he could pretty much dominate all of us in practice because he was that talented, that skilled. What Scott Skiles instilled in him was hard work. And Scott used to tell me all the time, and Scott helped me a lot how to watch film. He said, 3D, for me to be successful in this NBA, I have to outsmart people. I'm not going to outrun nobody. I'm not going to outjump anybody. I can shoot the ball with the best of them. I can pass with the best of them. And that was one of the things that Shaquille respected from Scott, that how hard he worked. And that's how they became respectful for one another.
Yeah, I saw that 30 for 30. It was terrific on those early years. And it just struck me that, you know, there could not have been, you know, from the outside, it would look like there could not have been two more different personalities at that time than Shaq and Scott Skiles.
But the only thing, though, Chris, and for your listeners, the only thing was different was the hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I respect about Scott Skiles so much, because he didn't have a lot of athletic ability, but he worked his tail off. And he was a student of the game. And I think that's what Shaquille started respecting about other guys around the NBA, is that, hey, there may be, say, and you know this, maybe 10 guys in our NBA that is flat out more talented, more athletic. There's nothing you can do with them.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next 10 superstars, they're smart, they have a skill set, they work hard, they take care of their bodies, things of that nature. And I think that's what Shaquille has respected over the years.
Was he consumed early on? I mean, you mentioned about his basketball role models of Ewing and Olajuwon. I mean, how consumed was he early on with trying to develop those types of skill sets that Ewing and Olajuwon had?
People used to, you know, mess with him and say, "Mal, he dunks too much. That's all he has is a dunk. What else can he do?" And then the whole hack of Shaq came along, and I used to always tell him, "Shaq, you're getting fouled because they can't stop you." That's different from fouling someone where they're trying to use it as a tactic in the game and slow down the game because the team is beating you. You're fouling out every center. You're fouling out every power forward that's trying to guard you. And that was the most fascinating thing, that he finally realized that everyone's right. I don't need a jump shot. Just continue to dominate people. They have to double team me. Now I have to become a better passer. And I think that's what he did later in his career.
How many times did you see him, either on his own or with the encouragement of the Magic, try to adjust his free throw shooting technique, whether it's, you know, how he does it, the time he takes, the routine? I mean, that was such an ongoing story throughout Shaq's career.
You hit around the head, Chris. Ongoing story. It's still ongoing. Even in some of his ads that he uses, the free throw thing will always follow him for the rest of his life. And he realizes that. But to answer your question, we had Buzz Brayman. We had different, you know, so-called free throw gurus come through Orlando, go to the Lakers. Every team he went on, they had some so-called coach. And to me, the coaches in Orlando were the ones, to me, and I think a few times in L.A. too, that the ones that kept it simple were the times you felt to feel comfortable, or have games where he was 13 of 13 and 11 of 11, or he might have been in the finals one time where he was, I think, 14 of 16 or something crazy like that, because they kept it simple, he found a rhythm, then he found some confidence, started making some shots in the playoffs when it was really crucial.
You were an 80% free throw shooter for your career. Did you ever sort of chime in with thoughts, advice, things like that?
All the time. And for me, it was find your rhythm. It's find your rhythm. We all have our own little way of shooting the basketball. And I always use Reggie Miller as a perfect example. When you watch Reggie Miller shoot, that thing is not pretty, but the result is pretty. And that's part of the confidence of finding your rhythm on how to shoot the basketball. And that's what I used to try to preach in his head. Find your rhythm. One dribble, two dribbles. Get to your spot. Leave it. Flick it up there. Find a rhythm. And then eventually he would find that and he became a better shooter in the playoffs.
Do you think it was more mental than physical? I think of what Stan Van Gundy says now about Andre Drummond. He says Drummond's in practice, and Stan swears he's knocking down 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 of his free throws. He gets to the game, and his head just... It just something goes on. Something clicks off in his head, and he becomes this horrendous free throw shooter. With Shaq, was it similar to that, or was it more a physical issue?
I think it was more mental, because physically, he would say, "Oh, I don't have a nice smooth flick of the wrist like you guys do." That's an excuse you make. That's, your hands are huge. The ball is like a volleyball in your hand. You just got to find some rhythm on your fingertips and shoot the ball. I said, "You don't have that problem when you shoot a baby hook." It's the same thing. I remember when Kareem used to always tell us, the old Mikan drill is with how he got to the sky hook. Mm-hmm. He would start doing it in close, and he would back out and back out, and that's how he became to the sky hook. So I said, Shaq, find that rhythm at the free throw line, block everyone out, and once you find that rhythm, shoot that same shot every time. And I think that's how he was able to develop a better free throw shot throughout the playoffs versus the regular season. But to answer your question, it is more mental with those big guys versus small guards.
Could you imagine if Shaq was a 75% free throw shooter? Just 75.
It wouldn't be fair. If he shot the free throw line, if he shot like Patrick Ewing or Kareem or Olajuwon,
it'd be unreal.
Even David Robinson was a pretty good free throw shooter for a big guy.
It'd be crazy. But it is hard for, I mean, the mental part of it aside, I always tell people, like, when you look at Shaq or any of these big men shooting, it's like taking a Nerf ball and shooting it at a Nerf hoop, like with these guys, because right. their hands envelop the ball. It's different than, you know, the average Joe shooting free throws with a flick of the wrist.
Well, they're 7 feet tall, their hands are bigger, their bodies are bigger, so now their depth perception to the rim is different from the average guard. But once those guys, like a guy like Rick Smits, who's even taller than Shaq, even Yao Ming, taller than Shaq, they were able to find a rhythm and a feel on the ball to shoot it, and I think that's the part we have to instill in our future big men. Yes, you are bigger. Yes, you are taller. Yes, you are stronger. Use that to an advantage. Feel the ball, find the seams, find a good rhythm, and shoot it.
Were there any dumb suggestions made to Shaq about his free throw shooting that you recall? Anyone tell him to do something that seemed just completely ridiculous?
The only one, and I'm sure some of your listeners may stir a little conversation with some of your listeners, was, you know, shooting the underhand with the whole Rick Barry underhand.
Yeah.
I know people. I know Rick Barry is successful with it. I know some people have tried it, you know, throughout the years. But I don't think that is something good for a big guy, because now you're asking a 7-footer to bring the ball down to his knees and then now shoot it up there, where now there is no follow through. There is no real. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. I know Rick Barry and I disagree on this one, but that was the only one I thought never really made sense. And he tried it maybe a week. Never got comfortable with it, never went back to it.
Oh, so he tried it, just didn't...
He tried it for like a week in practice, but never tried it in the game because he just never felt comfortable at all doing it, so that's why I never... And he talks about that a little bit too as well.
Yeah, there's a guy in this past summer league, I forget his name, but he's been doing it, and I think he's going to try to do it at the next level. Big man, maybe playing for Houston, I want to say, somebody who was shooting under him.
Yes, I do vaguely remember that.
Yeah, I wonder if he starts connecting at a decent rate if it catches on. It does look, I mean, it looks awkward, and I hear what you're saying. It just takes one guy to kind of do it and make it work for it to become, you know, a trend amongst some bigger men, I think.
Right.
Something like that. So the other relationship, Shaq and Penny, as most people have seen the documentary, which outlines a lot of what went into their relationship. What did you see in that locker room between those two guys early on and how it kind of developed over time?
Opposite personalities. Off the court, same personalities on the court. And I think that was, when you go back and you really watch that documentary, on the court, they clicked all day long. Eye contact, not a lot of words being said, because Shaq knew if he ran the floor hard every time, Penny would put the ball right on the dime. Mm-hmm. The alley-oops, the layups, when you watch Shaq Week on NBA TV, those early years of watching us play, we were up and down, rolling, sharing the basketball, because Penny Hardaway's IQ was off the charts as a basketball player. That's why we were so successful. I believe, when you go back and watch it, like they believe today, I think it was off the court. I think it was the Reebok versus Nike. You know, I think it was the agents forcing. Was it Shaq's team versus Penny's team? Once we got in the locker room, once we started playing, I was the voice saying, guys, forget about Nike and Reebok. Let's go hoop. Y'all can figure that out later. But once we get on the court, it doesn't matter what's on our feet. It's a matter of us continuing to play well and playing together and winning. All the other stuff will take care of itself. And that's what I said in the documentary. I think it was more of the off-the-court stuff that really messed up their relationship.
And that's amazing to me. And look, these are young guys. I mean, early 20s, the both of them. But it's still amazing to me that you know, shoe contracts or minor stuff off the court that would disrupt and ultimately destroy what could have been, you know, one of the great pairings in NBA history, it seems.
It really could have, Chris, because it was just a perfect combination inside out. The only thing, and Shaq admits in the documentary, the only small few would be late-game situations who would get the ball. A lot of times we would give it to Penny because if we gave it to Shaq, they would foul him.
Mm-hmm.
So then Shaq would get mad because we would take him out of the game sometime. We'd do that little offense-defensive thing. And then I understood what he was going through. I said, big fella, you got to keep your head in the game because I go through the same thing. When we go offense-defense, you come in the game for defense, I come out. And then when we go offense, I come back in the game, you come out because they're afraid to foul you. I make free throws. So it was a mind game early on in his career. He had to realize that it wasn't that you weren't less of a player. It's just that in these situations, are you helping the team or hurting the team because you know they're going to foul you? That may be the only thing that he and Penny may have bumped heads with because late game situations, if there was a minute left in the game, we're down one or up one, and he got the ball, they were going to hit and foul him.
At what point, Dennis, did you start getting worried about what was going to happen to that team? Because year three, you're in the NBA Finals. Year four, you go to the Eastern Conference Finals. But at what point do you start thinking, like, you know, oh, this might not end all that well?
I think it's when his grandmother passed. And once again, well documented in the documentary, he wanted to stay in Newark, you know, a couple extra days to grieve some more with his mom and the rest of his family. And ownership wanted him to rush back for a Chicago game. We were playing on NBC on a Sunday. And I think we lost that game, like one or two.
Mm-hmm.
Shaq got there the middle of the first quarter, ended up playing, probably shouldn't have played. And I think that was the beginning of us losing him. Because all the other stuff he was able to deal with, but when it got to a point where they didn't have that extra couple of days of remorse for him to grieve with his family, that was the beginning of the downfall of Shaq leaving Orlando.
What changed? You said he was a little bit different after that. How would you describe the difference in him after that?
Just the 4 years of being in Orlando, learning from that, being around Jerry West, being around Phil Jackson, being around those type of leaders, those type of Hall of Famers, really got the mental side of his game to the next level. Because the physical side of his game was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was the mental side. Becoming a better passer. Making the free throws when you needed to. Becoming a better teammate, you know, on and off the floor. And that sounds crazy because every team he's been on, every person says a great teammate. But sometimes you have to understand why each guy's role is what they were. And I think when he got to L.A., he really, really, really embraced that and figured that out. That's why he became such a better teammate.
So that was such a lighthearted team and a fun team to be around. And you two kind of were at the kind of the focal points of that. I mean, Shaq was a prankster for sure. I've got my own. I'll tell you my own Shaq prank story because he got me, Dennis. I was in Boston. I was in Boston, and I was a locker room guy for the Celtics for like 10 years, you know, eight, nine years. Mm-hmm. And I was working the visiting locker room 1 year, and another one of the locker room guys went up to Shaq and his security guard there. I forgot his name, but the longtime security guard. And he says, you know, that guy over there was talking smack about you, was saying some nasty things about your game. So there's like this little hallway between the visiting locker room and the coach's room. And Shaq and his security guy quartered me there. And I'm like, you know, 6 feet, 170 pounds, soaking wet. Like, not big, goofy glasses on my face back at that time. And Shaq, you know, just like is right up against me. Said, I heard you were saying some stuff about me. And I'm just mumbling. No, I didn't do nothing like that. Then he grabs me by the back and gives me a wedgie. Lifts me up in the air with a wedgie, man. Nailed me. Got me right there.
Well,
he got me. But The best prank you saw Shaq do or that you and Shaq pulled together?
Ooh. I'm going to try to keep this as clean, but it sounds nasty, though. May he rest in peace. our good friend, ex-teammate, Brooks Thompson, passed away a little while ago. But Shaq used to always have it out for him and used to love to mess with him. So before practice one day, Shaq goes into the stall and uses the restroom, as we say, number two. Try to keep clean for your listeners. And he wipes himself, and he puts the tissue in Brooks's shoe.
Oh.
Brooks is late for practice that day, ironically. Rushes in, gets tape, puts his shoes on, runs out there on the court and get ready for practice. It's like, man, something's in my why my feet feel funny? So then halfway through practice, takes off his shoe, and there it was, a big old glob of toilet paper with number two all over.
That is awful. That is awful.
I try to keep it as clean as possible.
No. That was, I mean, fantastic telling of the story, Dennis. Don't get me wrong, but God, did you guys all know that he did that? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes. All the guys, it might have been about four or five of us who were still in the locker room getting dressed for practice, saw him do it. And, you know, Shaq was like, y'all better shut up. Otherwise, I'm going to get you. And we just kind of laughed, and went out there, started warming up practice. And three or four of us just kept laughing. We just couldn't stop laughing. And finally, we started practice. And next thing you know, he said, man, there's something in my shoe. What is that? Then we go, ooh, man, you got stinky foot. Ooh, you got stinky foot.
Now, do you get Shaq back? Is he the kind of guy you prank back?
No question about it. You always do. You always get him back. And that was the fun part for me, that for like whatever reason, thank you, John Gable, for letting me go pick him up that day, because I was the one that was able to get away with more stuff. Like all the rookie hazing, he carried my bag his whole rookie year. And that's the part where he's like, I'm not doing a rookie hazing. So I remember one time in Milwaukee, practice is over, and I said, look, guys, I need your help on this one. And we took all the balls off the rack and threw them all up in the stands. And he was the rookie. He had to go get them.
Did you ever?
Because the whole team helped me, that's what helped seal the deal.
Okay, if he was your rookie, though.
Himself, he probably would have got on me.
If he was your rookie, did you ever make him do something? Like, I remember the stories of, like, Kevin Garnett is kind of legendary with how he's handled rookies. Like, he'll call a rookie's hotel room in the middle of the night and say, go get me a bar of soap. And rookie's got to go find himself a bar of soap. Did you ever try to pull something besides carrying the bag with Shaq?
Shaq was most times just carried a bag, or because he, you know, obviously had the big contract, I'd make him treat all of us either, you know, breakfast or lunch like that. That's before Terry Catton left the team. Terry Catton used to get him to get the newspaper in the morning. Nothing really too outrageous. You know, snow on the ground, make him, you know, take the bags off the bus, put them on the plane in the snow, stuff like that. But nothing too outrageous. He was the one that really, really crossed the line doing stuff.
How did he treat his rookies?
He wasn't, I mean, Brooks Thompson, like that story probably was the nastiest. I remember one time, I think it was Chris Cortiani. No, it wasn't Chris Cortiani. He may go unload the bags in the snow with no coat on in Orlando. I'm sure there's some other crazy stories he was doing in L.A., but you just never knew when you came to practice on any given day. You had to always make sure you checked your lockers, checked your shoes. You know, you had to check your jock strap or your compression shorts, because you might have some Flexol or Bengay in there.
Before I let you go, you were there the year after that Shaq left as well. What did Shaq's departure kind of do to Penny Hardaway? Because he was never really the same. I know injuries factored, but you know, did Penny try to take on too much after the fact? I mean, do you think Shaq's departure, you know, kind of hastened the end of his career as well?
Injuries. Period. If Penny Hardaway would not have gotten injured, we'd still be talking about Penny Hardaway.
Because
that's how special he was. IQ off the charts, could shoot the three, he could handle the ball, he could post up. His vision as a passer, second to none. You know, I always say between he and Kenny Anderson, you know, those two guys have different styles as point guards. Those are my two favorite point guards playing with, because they always put the ball on me where it needed to be. Just unfortunate that Penny hurt that knee and never could get back athletically like he once was.
A healthy Penny Hardaway and Shaq against a healthy Kobe and Shaq. Who do you got?
Ooh, that is a tough one. The reason it's so tough, because I I never got a chance to see Penny get his to grown man status, what I call it.
Mm-hmm.
Kobe showed us what grown man status is.
Yeah.
I would probably give the nose dive to Kobe because Kobe was a lockdown defender.
Yeah.
That's what gives Kobe the nod. Kobe could lock down 1, 2, and 3. Penny was a good defender, but he wasn't a lockdown defender.
Would have been something to see Penny 2+ years down with Shaq.
It really would have been because it's a great question, Chris, and from your listeners. I got a chance to play with Penny for a couple of years, and I got that 1 year to be in training camp with Kobe and Shaq in L.A. before they let me go. So I got a chance to see both of them in the lab. And I think that's the part you know from being around the game a long time. Watching a guy practice sometimes is better than watching a guy play in a game.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Shaq regrets the end in Orlando or the end in L.A. more?
Today, when the smoke settles, I think he says Orlando because he says if he'd have handled his business in Orlando, L.A. never would have been a situation.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting how he broke that down. He said, because if I would have been a little more mature, maybe I stay. Maybe Penny doesn't get hurt. Maybe more players come to Orlando and play with me. And now maybe Orlando is the destination to be instead of Miami with D-Wade and LeBron, as we finally found out.
They might not have been in movies, though.
Well, what he learned was, and I'm glad we finished up with that, what he learned was he was able to go to L.A., do his first two movies, and come right back to Orlando and play.
Yeah. And that's the way it is now, isn't it? Russell Westbrook goes to, like, Milan in the summer. Now.
All the guys realize, get a summertime home in L.A. You got a trainer. You got a gym. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
Work on your game. You do your movie. You take care of your body. Any other appearances you may have, commercials you're going to shoot, you do it all in L.A. Summertime's over. You go back to your city during the season and you play. That's how it works.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, you're the best, man. I know you got to go, but I appreciate you taking some time to talk to me here and reliving some of those experiences, man.
No problem. Appreciate it, Chris.
You're listening to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
And now a word from Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts out of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork? With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all this on your phone or tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/Mannix. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
One of the greatest little men to ever play the game, one of the greatest players to ever play the game, is headed to the Hall of Fame this week. Allen Iverson, an incredible career, has been an MVP, a scoring champion, you know, has done more with less perhaps than any player physically in NBA history, and a guy that was right there with him, helping to mold him, working with him, was Larry Brown, his longtime coach. And Larry joins me here on the podcast. Larry, take me back to 1997 when you take the coaching job in Philadelphia. Allen Iverson is just finishing that first year. What did you know about him then?
Well, I've always been a fan of college ball, even though at the time I was a pro coach. So I got to watch Allen play college, and I was obviously a fan of John Thompson and what he did at Georgetown. And, you know, we all were probably aware of, you know, what Allen had been through. But, you know, I remember watching his rookie year in the league. They didn't win a lot of games. And, you know, he was a tremendous individual talent. But I was just anxious for the opportunity to get to coach him. And I can't say every single day was perfect, but looking back, it was really a blessing for me to be associated with him, and I think it's really helped me as my career moved forward, having the opportunity to be around Allen.
Was he a big reason that you wanted that job?
No, not really. I thought I was going to coach the Celtics, you know, Larry Bird had called me, and then I had heard from the Celtics, and they were going to replace ML Carr, and I had an understanding that I would be the next coach, and lo and behold, they hired Rick Pitino, and then Pat Croce came to interview me. I think Sonny Hill got him to interview me. I got the job, and I was looking at having the opportunity to coach Allen and Jerry Stackhouse, and was excited for that opportunity, but it wasn't about any individual player. I just felt real comfortable meeting Mr. Snyder and Pat Croce, and you know, having an opportunity to coach in a town like Philly that loved basketball so much, I was thrilled for that chance.
Take me through that first year, Larry, with Allen and being around him. What were some of the things you wanted to accomplish early, and what were some early kind of points of friction between you two guys?
Well, we got the second pick in the draft, and Keith Van Horn didn't want to come, and we ended up being able to trade Van Horn and got Tim Thomas and got rid of some really bad contracts. And my biggest challenge was to try to get Allen to go from being a point guard to a scoring guard. And as great as Jerry Stackhouse was and Allen was, it was not a good fit. It wasn't fair to Jerry. You know, before Allen got there, they talked about the Spectrum being Stackhouse. And then Allen came in, and they both won, believable individually, but as a backcourt, it wasn't fair to either one of them to have to play together. So we ended up moving Jerry, and he got a lot of kind of different type of role players, and finally got Allen to realize that it would be better for him and our team if he played off the ball, and we got him the ball, and his growth became almost instant. I think he was probably as good a scorer as I've ever been involved with or ever been around. When he was playing point guard, he had to beat five guys. When he was playing off guard, you know, we could get him the ball and move the defense and surround him with players that complimented him and respected what he did. It wasn't an easy transition for him, because he looked at himself as a point guard. I've said it many times, Isaiah and Tiny Archibald were two of the best little guys I've ever seen. And I put Allen in that category. But Allen was the most unique player I've ever been around. His competitive spirit, his will to win, his ability to score the ball is just unbelievable. But it was a difficult transition for both of us getting to understand how to deal with each other.
He played some unbelievable minutes per game in your years together. Just looking at the list, I mean, led the league in minutes, I'm counting 5-6 times in his first 6-7 years, 43 and a half minutes in 01, 02. When he's out there, I mean, did you ever worry, like, this guy's so slender, small. I mean, did you ever fear you were going to burn him out?
Well, he was mad at me that I ever took him out. I always laugh about it, but I took him out twice a game just before the end of the first quarter so he'd get a long rest, and put him in shortly after the second quarter started. And I did the same thing at the end of the third quarter. And every time I took him out, he cursed me. And first couple of times I'd get upset, and then after a while I realized he just was so competitive. He wanted to be in the game. He wanted to play every minute, and I think he could have, you know, in today's climate, or you know, wherever I've been prior to coaching Allen or since Allen, I've never seen anybody, you know, with that kind of stamina or durability or take the punishment that he took, and yet, you know, was ready to play at the drop of a hat. It was remarkable. I don't think any other player could have done that, to be honest, other than Wilt. You know, Wilt played almost every minute when he played for Coach McGuire. I think the only time he ever didn't play was when he got thrown out of a game. But you're talking about a 7'2" guy that was you know, most unbelievable specimen. Now we're talking about a 6-foot, 155-pounder that wanted to play every minute. It was pretty incredible.
When did you stop taking his anger at coming out of games personally? When did you kind of say, you know, all right, this is just kind of how he is, and I've got to kind of let it go?
Oh, pretty quickly. You know, I didn't realize that at the time that, you know, we were growing closer and closer together. I could almost say anything to Alan privately. I could say the good and the bad to him privately, and he would accept it without reservation. If I, in his mind, was critical of him in front of a group or in front of his teammates, he couldn't handle it, and I figured that out. And also learned not to take anything he did personally, because as I got to know him more and more, and as I got to realize his relationship with his teammates, I realized that was just who he was, an unbelievable competitor who I think at the end of the day would do almost anything for me. It took a while. And I know as I look back on my experience with him, it wasn't easy. There were times that it was pretty difficult for me, because I came from a program and coaches that he treated 1 through 15 the same way. And the most important thing is you respected one another, and the team always came first. And sometimes I didn't realize Alan was trying to do that, but he had a different way of doing it. And now looking back, you know, like I said before, it's helped me to become a better person and a better coach. And my admiration for him has grown, you know. And I think at the time I realized how special he was, but I'm even more aware of that now.
When did it reach kind of a critical mass for you, Larry? When did you feel like you were at kind of your breaking point with Alan, and how did you get past it?
I think every day that was the case. Every time out, you know, that's just the way our relationship evolved. I had a lot of help. You know, I had Eric Snow and Aaron McKee and Derek Coleman and Tyrone Hill and Theo and Mutombo. They all, you know, let me know about Alan and let me know that it was just Alan being Alan. There was nothing ever personal. His will to win was so great. His competitor's spirit was so strong that it made him do and say things that he really didn't mean. It was not easy dealing with that and accepting that. But because of the coaches I was surrounded with and the players that I was lucky enough to coach, they made me understand what he was about. And I'm hopeful, you know, that I allowed him to be Alan, that we helped bring out the very best in him. You know, because that's, when you're a coach and you deal with David Thompson and David Robinson and Derek Coleman and, you know, the special players I was fortunate enough to coach, it's a tremendous obligation for you to allow them to be who they are. And I'm hopeful that I was able to do that. I think if I had it to do all over again, there might have been some things I would change, but I don't know if the results would be any different. I think he was a sensational player and a sensational teammate in his own way, and no better competitor ever. And getting in the Hall of Fame the first time you're eligible with the group of people he's going with just validates, you know, what I feel about him.
You never know early on, I would imagine, that it's tough to know if a guy is going to be truly special, to be a Hall of Famer at some point in his career. But when you look back at your first couple of years with him, or first few years, was there a point in time in those first few years, Larry, that you looked at him and said, you know, this guy could really be one of the all-time greats?
Well, he's the greatest athlete I've ever seen. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying that and, you know, trying to hurt other people that are unbelievably athletic and gifted. But I've never seen anybody so athletic. I don't think there's ever been anybody at his size more competitive. I think, to be honest with you, he could have been an all-star in any sport he ever chose. I recognized the talent right away. I didn't know if he would ever be able to buy into what I was asking him to do. And we had to change. We had to change the people we had to surround him with. We had to change the style of play that I was accustomed to teaching and what I was taught and what I believed in and the values I had. But talent-wise, I never saw anybody like him, and I don't think we'll ever see anybody like him in the future.
Yeah, that 2001 team that you had, the one that went to the finals where Allen was the MVP, that'll go down as a truly unique team because of what Allen was able to do that year. When you think about that team in particular, what comes to mind?
We would have beaten the Lakers if we were healthy. Nobody believes me when I say that, but, you know, George Lynch didn't play. Aaron McKee was hurt. Matt Geiger only played one game, the game we won. And we were in every game. And then, you know, a few years later, I was with Detroit, and we beat the Lakers 4-1 and should have swept them. But if you look at that team, we had Rodney Buford, Kevin Ollie. We got Rajah Bell out of the YMCA. We had Jermaine Jones starting. It was just a group of guys that, you know, Mutombo and Hill, Eric Snow and Aaron McKee and Allen, basically, and a bunch of no-names. And we were able to almost beat the Lakers with that group. And they had won 19 straight, I think, playoff games prior to us beating them in game one. Game two, we could have won. We missed a bunch of free throws. And it was because of Allen and some unbelievable, tough, competitive guys. But I know in my heart that if Aaron would have been healthy and George would have played and Geiger would have played, I really, truly believe we would have won because of Allen's greatness.
When I look at that team, I especially with Allen that year, 31 points, led the league in scoring, led the league in steals that year, played 42 minutes a game that year. You're hard-pressed, I think anyway, to find a better individual performance than what Allen did that season, not just putting up the numbers, but leading that team. When everyone feels like everyone kind of knew every night that it was, you know, you stop Allen, you can beat Philadelphia, but he was just so unstoppable that year.
Well, I've been blessed. I've been around some great teams, but everywhere I go, people always marvel at that team because of the grit and because of the greatness of Allen and the toughness and the heart of that group. You go into Philly and people revere that team because of Allen and the type of people that Allen played with and the fact that every night they competed at the highest level. You know, you look around now in the NBA and everybody says you got to have three superstars to win. I don't think people understand what a superstar is. You know, a superstar makes other people better. And it's not necessarily scoring the ball. And I thought we had a lot of superstars on that team in their own right. And that's why I'm so convinced we would have won. Had everybody been healthy. I know that might be heresy, me saying that. But, a lot of people might have stopped Allen. Allen some games was 12 for 38 or 12 for 39, and mm-hmm. we won. And people used to say, well, we could have scored 30 a game if we took the shots Allen took. Well, it takes a special player to take those shots, to get those shots. And the fact that, you know, we knew we could throw him the ball and he could get a shot really was our best offense because either he made it and if he missed it, we usually got an offensive rebound because he commanded so much attention. But people did try to stop him. They always put their best players on him. He faced double and triple teams. And you know, again, when you don't have people around him that are noted for scoring the ball, they can, you know, pay more attention to him. So the fact that he was able to score 31 a game and accomplish what he did, I think just is a testament to his, you know, unbelievable talent.
When you look back at the fights or the conflict that you had with Iverson in those years, is there one you laugh at now that you look back and say, I can't believe we were so fired up over
X, Y, or Z, whatever it was?
No, I think none of them were ever personal. It was a coach trying to get this great, great player to do the right thing on and off the court, you know, in every facet of his life. And a young player, you know, trying to be who he was. And that's not easy. Allen wanted to be Allen. He wasn't ready to conform. He wasn't ready to be what other people wanted him to be. And I don't think many players went through the hardships that he had endured growing up and, you know, going to jail for that fight in the bowling alley, which really, from what I understand, was not his fault at all. But he had overcome so many obstacles that I think as a coach, I had to do a better job of being sensitive to that. But the way I was brought up and the coaches that I played for and the values that they placed in me, I think I tried to get Allen to realize that. And the only regret I have is that I couldn't do a better job of making him understand how special he was and how many kids wanted to be like him and how he had this gift that if he could have done all the things that maybe we all had hoped for, that he could have influenced a lot more kids than he actually did. And I really don't think anybody was more beloved by, you know, young players than Allen Iverson. So I guess he did accomplish, you know, the things he needed to.
We're talking about Allen now, Larry, because he's a Hall of Famer and he's a first ballot Hall of Famer and one of the greatest players of all time. But in some ways, could he have even been even better? Could his career have gone even better if he had done certain things differently?
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, when I got fired in Charlotte, I went all over the country trying to watch people coach and learn because, you know, when I was a pro coach, people used to come to see us because we started our season earlier and went longer, so I never got to watch other people coach. And there wasn't one time that I didn't go to a college and watch kids play that all of them didn't come up to me after practice and tell me Allen Iverson was the favorite player growing up and wanted me to tell them stories about Allen. And I try to let Allen understand the impact he was having on our game and young people, and I don't think he ever realized it. But I tell him all the time, you know, he always tells everybody, wish he would have listened to the things I had told him when he was playing for me. And I hate to hear him say that. I don't want him to apologize. He has nothing to apologize because when you were talking to me and introducing me, telling me that I coached one of the greatest players that ever played, and the fact that he's a first ballot Hall of Fame selection at 160 pounds, you just answered that question. I just wish, you know, in my heart that I could have been with him longer. I don't think I was around him long enough. And if I would have had that opportunity to be around him longer, I think we all would have benefited. Our game would have benefited by that.
Before I let you go, the Allen Iverson performance, individual performance in a game or some type of setting that stands out to you the most?
You know, the thing that I remember most about Allen is we would be in a game and struggling, and he would do something that he'd look at Mike Woodson or John Kuster or Mo Cheeks or Bob Bender or any one of my assistants and go, wow, did you see him, what he just did? And we all would look at each other and laugh because we'd never seen it before, didn't think anybody could ever do that. So that happened so many times in so many games that he would do something that, you know, you would probably shake your head and say that we're not going to see that happen again. And then lo and behold, he'd do something even more incredible the next night. I think Phil Jackson could probably tell you that about Michael, you know, or somebody could tell you that about Wilt or, you know, Jerry West, people like that, you know, like LeBron does now. But he would do these extraordinary things that I think I would just marvel at him. Now, I don't know if he did it in practice, but he did it in the game time and time again. So I think that's the best way I could answer that question.
Oh, practice. It always comes back to that, right, Larry?
You know, and that really troubles me because he wasn't there at that press conference to talk about practice. He just answered the question the right way in his heart because he was there to talk about a discussion he had with me that he was going to stay in Philly and be there and play for me. And that was all he was concerned with. But unfortunately, I think that people interpreted that wrong. But he didn't like practice, and there's a lot of great players. You know, I played with Rick Barry, who was one of the greatest players of all time, and he was the worst practice player I've ever been around. But as soon as you turn the lights on, before he hurt his knee, he was as good as any player that's ever played. I played with Billy Cunningham in college, and Billy didn't like practice at all, but you turn the lights on and he would do extraordinary things. Alan just happened to play for a coach that was too demanding and wanted greatness every single day, every single practice. And it was a little conflicting for him. But, you know, he was as good as it gets. And I'm so happy that, you know, I'm going to be in Springfield to watch him, you know, receive that honor.
Well, Larry, I appreciate the time here. I know this Hall of Fame weekend, as you mentioned, will be special for you. Thanks for taking some time to come on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Take care. See you soon. Bye. That's it. My thanks to Dennis Scott and Larry Brown for joining the show. Don't forget, if you like this episode and if you like this podcast in general, feel free to give us a rating, leave a comment. You know I appreciate it. As always, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. We'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.